This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Treasures in the Dark, 90 Reflections on Finding Bright Hope Hidden in the Hurting, written and narrated by Catherine Wolfe, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Your eyes on the times, you walk ready to speak up, but with so many problems, you're exhausted trying to keep up.
This is the Church Politics Podcast, where you can get political commentary from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be conservative or progressive. We're trying to be Christian in the public square.
And I'm black as heaven. I'm made in God's image. Nobody can change my settings. Amen. Amen. Cut off my knees and put an end to my search. It's easy to sell your soul when you don't know what it's worth.
What you know, good Ann Camp, you're listening to the Ann Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, a.k.a. Bishop Cooper's grandson, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, my play cousin, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Chris, how was your Memorial Day weekend, my brother?
It was good. I did a lot of yard work and then hung out with my parents on actual Memorial Day.
Okay. Yeah, we had a good time. We went to Florida. The boys had fun, so it was a good time. You know, remember those who have passed and all that stuff. But was really solid. So one thing I want to mention before we get into our three main topics is it looks like a deal has been reached in principle when it comes to the debt ceiling. If that is indeed the case, then I think the Speaker of the House deserves some credit because a lot of people weren't sure if he would be able to pull this off and get enough Republicans to actually sign on to this. A lot of people thought they would have to bring it to the brink, which in turn, as we've talked about before, could have had a really serious impact on the economy. And I think either Wall Street or somebody wasn't trying to have that. And so it looks like they may be coming to an agreement. It looks like he gets the votes and more votes than he needed, but you never know. And so we will keep our eyes on that. Any thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think Church Politics Podcast listeners know that we won't just jump directly into something. We'll let this unfold. But I have a lot of thoughts about the deal. But certainly, I think folks have clearly underestimated Speaker McCarthy. He went through a sort of eventful speakership fight, but he won that fight. And he's gotten a few things done here now. So
yeah, and certainly there are speakers who are better than others, but you don't get to speaker and not have any idea what you're doing. And people did kind of try to play McCarthy and say, you know, he has no clue what he's doing. He's going to get eaten alive. There are a lot of people that think he doesn't have a core, but to say that he doesn't know how to maneuver within the Republican spaces seems to be a major exaggeration, especially if he pulls this off. So
yeah,
we will see. As you guys know, initially, President Biden said that he wouldn't negotiate. Then he ends up negotiating. I don't know that it's a huge win for either side once we look at what they've agreed to in principle, but it's definitely something for us all to keep our eyes on. So y'all pay attention to that and we will keep you updated as well. I want to remind y'all before we get into this episode for real that you got to go and read the Invisible Institution or IVI newsletter. We have some great writers writing on that, including yours truly, Chris, and myself. So go check that out. The May issue is out. The June issue is coming. And so we want everybody to go check that out when you have a chance. Also, along with that IVI, and if you go onto the website, you can also check out our How I Got Over docuseries, which is a 5-part series about the role that the authority of Scripture played in the Black church throughout history. Some you got to know, some you got to check out. A lot of smart minds, including folks like Lisa Fields, Dr. Esau McCauley, so many other folks. Dr. Vince Bantu added to that and really made it a great docuseries, and we need everybody to watch it. We even have large churches around the country taking the time during Bible study and things of that nature to watch that video. So I would advise you all to check it out. And then we have something really important coming up tomorrow. So this might be today. If you're hearing this on Thursday, you need to go to the Ann Campaign's YouTube page and or its Instagram page and watch our new Whole Life Project video. This is going to be a video that's about the sanctity of life. It's about correcting the narrative. And all of y'all need to go check that out immediately. All right? So check it out. Share it with friends. We think this could have a major impact. Because really all we want to do, we're not going to change everybody's mind. But we do want them to start thinking about the abortion conversation and not just repeating talking points. Like, that's really what we want people to do. I think a lot of people have heard the talking points from their side, and that's as much as they thought about the issue. And we want people to apply, especially Christians, to apply the love and truth of the gospel to that conversation. And we might come out with a different conclusion. All right. So as always, we want to give a shout out to our sponsor, the Fetzer Institute, for supporting us in what we do and how we do it. Also, a shout out to all those who are patrons on patreon.com/churchpolitics. We appreciate you. If you are a patron, just know that you actually get extra episodes here and there. So this episode, we're going to go and talk about the use of the word elite. Whether it's a good thing, whether it's a bad thing, or whether it's just an accurate description of certain groups within our society that can be constructive. So we'll have a conversation about that, and hopefully you will be there to join us if you are a patron. All right, we know what it is, so grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think, not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but to think like a Christian. All right, Chris, and you know this history. As part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Operation Breadbasket in the 60s, Black clergy who were involved in the civil rights movement encouraged churchgoers to boycott certain products and picket businesses who sold those products. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said that the fundamental premise of Breadbasket is a simple one. It's that Negroes need not patronize a business which denies them jobs or advancement or plain courtesy. Dr. King also said that many retail businesses and consumer goods industries deplete the ghetto by selling to Negroes without returning to the community any of the profits through fair hiring practices. This was called selective patronage, and it led many companies over time to change their discriminatory practices. Okay, it proved that boycotts can be effective. Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but I think I remember seeing this from Dr. King. It could have been somebody else who said that, so don't quote me on this one in particular. But I think it was also Dr. King who talked about that there was a such thing as immoral boycotts or immoral protests. These were boycotts, I believe, that had the purpose of pushing immoral ends, or boycotts that would reinforce segregation or further marginalize certain communities. Right. So we see that there are constructive boycotts, which, you know, are just civil, you know, can be civil disobedience in part, that actually have just ends, right, in mind. But then there are boycotts that really become just economic terrorism. And to give you an example of that would be something that you might see, Chris, from the White Citizens Council. So we know that the KKK terrorized Black people and others really through physical harm and threats of physical violence. Well, the White Citizens Council, during some of that same time, actually use economic terrorism. So they would punish businesses and others who desegregated. That, I believe, would be, you know, an example of an immoral kind of protest or immoral boycott. Okay. Now, the reason that I bring this up is recently we've been seeing some very successful boycotts coming from conservatives. I would have to say, Chris, that conservatives have scored some points based on the success of a few boycotts. I want to go through these boycotts, but what I want you to think about is, do these boycotts fit the SCLC model, or are they more of the immoral kind of boycott? All right, so keep that in mind as we go through this. The first boycott that I saw, Chris, that really recently was shown to be effective was the boycott of Budweiser. Okay, according to a recent estimate I saw, Budweiser has lost $15.7 billion. Billion with a B, $15.7 billion in value since placing a transgender influencer on one of its cans. This influencer, I believe, is pretty provocative. And people responded by saying, we're just not going to buy Budweiser anymore. Budweiser came out. I don't think they necessarily apologized, but they certainly took those cans off the shelf. And if you follow any of this stuff on social media, it seems to have been really impactful. And Budweiser, I don't expect we'll be doing that again anytime soon. From what I've read, again, I don't think they apologize, but I do think they've done some things to show that they probably won't be doing that again. The next one that you hear about, Chris, is Target. Target has lost over $10 billion with a B in market valuation after putting up a pride display in the children's section of the store. This included from my understanding, certain clothes that children could wear if they were transgender or pre-op transgender. And so people didn't respond well to that. Now, I want to be very clear, because some people on the left are saying, just some of them, not all of them, some people left are saying that the loss, the $10 billion loss, had nothing to do with the boycott. Others are saying that this actually is, boy, I saw somebody say that this boycott is actually terrorism. And many people have commented and are worried about what this means for where we are within this conversation. The next boycott, or the next issue that I should say, deals with the LA Dodgers, who were celebrating Pride and decided to re-invite Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to their Pride celebration in kind of honor of this group. Now, Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, it doesn't sound like a Christian group, does it? Is a leading edge, according to themselves, a leading edge order of queer and trans nuns. Queer and trans nuns. Now, based on the name, based on the pictures that I've seen, these people aren't really nuns. And so it does seem to be an organization that kind of mocks Catholicism and things of that nature. In fact, there was a player on the Dodgers who voiced his displeasure with what was going on. Also, Trevor Williams, who was a pitcher for the Washington Nationals, said this: "To invite and honor a group that makes a blatant and deeply offensive mockery of my religion and the religion of over 4 million people in Los Angeles County alone undermines the values of respect and inclusivity that should be upheld by any organization." Now, if you're hearing this on Thursday, it will be the first day of Pride Month. So you'll be hearing a lot of probably some controversies about that and just a lot of information and celebration of the LGBTQ community. Now, I personally do not celebrate that for obvious reasons. You know that the AND campaign believes in the historic Christian sexual ethic. I don't believe that, you know, most people who are in that community are any more wicked or sinful than me. But I do think, especially when it comes to transgenderism and things of that nature, that there is, in the overall ideology, a wickedness there. Again, that doesn't mean that everybody in that's their intention. But I think there is something that Christians should push back on when it comes to that. I think there's a spiritual element to all this. And I think a lot of Christians who are more accepting of some of these things aren't paying attention to that spiritual element and what it could mean in the long term if we just wipe away some of the distinctions between sex and gender. And so we have to think about that. But Chris, what I also wanted us to think about and be very honest about is how the church hasn't, going into Pride, whether we celebrate it or not, going into Pride, understanding where the church has gone wrong when it comes to that community, understanding that we could have done better, should have done better, and that we didn't. And as I've said many times, going into these conversations with a broken heart, understanding that folks in these spaces are just trying to, you know, live through the human condition, and people, you know, and people come to different conclusions when that happens. We know that the Bible is the way to move forward with that. But I think we also have to acknowledge where Christians haven't followed what we said we believed and haven't shown the compassion that we should have. So as we go into this conversation, I want to acknowledge that. Chris, you know, before we really evaluate which space these kind of boycotts are in, just want to hear your point of view on the topic in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think the activity of boycotting, I think, is a very important activity and a very important tactic. As I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about it in a slightly different headspace. I think about where kind of leadership and activism is going to be needed in the future. I think that the kind of next generation of activism is going to have to include a strong element of the ability of everyday citizens to band together and confront corporate power. And the boycott is one of the primary tools that enables that type of action. And so I think it's very, very important right now how we are thinking about boycotting and how we are presenting it to the world. Because I have a very, you know, I think that everybody, not everybody, but most people have heard of a boycott, but most people have not ever really contemplated a boycott. And I remember the first time I actually contemplated a boycott. I was a kid, and this liquor store in the neighborhood that I grew up in Austin, on the west side of Chicago, I started selling fruit juice in a half pint glass bottle. And so you had like little kids walking around, you know, drinking from this bottle that looked like, you know, a little half pint of Thunderbird or something. And I was only in like maybe seventh or eighth grade, but I was super upset about just seeing this because, you know, I hadn't heard the term grooming, but it certainly seemed like wildly inappropriate to see a 7-year-old doing that. And some of the older kids in the seventh and eighth grade, you know, leave the bottle in a brown paper bag and, you know, drinking fruit juice that way. And so I was part of a community youth group at that time. We met with the organizers who were mentoring us. And, you know, after talking with all of our local elected officials and realizing that none of them had the right combination of willingness and ability to actually intervene, they talked to us about organizing a boycott of this liquor store. And we did. And we won. So that introduction to boycotting for me was very empowering. And so I think that is really important as a generation of kind of leaders and activists are coming up, that the orientation that they have toward boycotting is right. I've become very engaged in how boycotting is done and for what purpose and how it's perceived, especially in this moment.
So you've been in this for a minute, man. I mean, this you're not new to this.
This is what I've done. I mean, I was like 12, 13.
You were born for this, it sounds like, man. but no, I mean, I agree with you. I think boycotting is very important. And you see that through Operation Breadbasket. There were some very important victories won there. And the thing about boycotts is they take discipline, right? They take coming together and as a community having discipline. If we boycott, we get 100 people to do it with us and we're the only two that actually do it, it's not going to go very far. So that's a big part of kind of community organizing and getting people together. Now, as I look at these boycotts, Budweiser, Target, whatever is going on with the Dodgers, I would have to say that it's different than Operation Breadbasket, right? No one's responding to the exclusion of someone due to race. Nobody's responding to, you know, them not being able to come into the store or not hire certain people, right? It seems to be a different purpose, a different impetus, and maybe even to some extent a different objective outside of the fact that you obviously want to have an impact on the corporation. So I do think clearly there's a big difference between these and Operation Breadbasket. I don't know that we'll get too much pushback for that. We may, though. I don't know why I said that. We probably could.
I would say that it's a different time and there are different issues at play in culture today.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different time. I'm just saying the impetus wasn't racial discrimination, right? That's
I know. I'm just trying to head off some of
it. I hear you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Probably won't, though.
For what it's worth. So I do see that difference. I think that distinction is very important. At the same time, number one, I think the companies have every right, if they want to celebrate Pride, put up displays and all that stuff, they have every right to do that. And I think people who respond to that have every right. So while this might not be like Operation Breadbasket, people have every right to say, you know what, I don't want to support a store where your messaging is sexualizing children, aimed at children in a way that I think it sexualizes them. I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to support that. And I want to register my issues with you by not coming to your store anymore. I think that's absolutely fair. I'll be honest with you. I don't like to go into places necessarily where there's all that kind of messaging all over. And I think in many instances, it has gone too far. Progressives like to introduce their issues as neutral. And so, what's the big deal? This is just a neutral issue. This is not a neutral issue. I've said many times before that this is not an issue that has gone through the public discourse. Certain people think they can just skip the public discourse. And a lot of people, even some of my more progressive friends, don't feel comfortable where a lot of this is going. It's hard to disconnect what's happening at Target. Budweiser, you don't have the same issue with children, but it's more of a statement, right? There's a difference there too. But it's hard, if you take the Target example, it's hard to disconnect what's going on at Target from the fact that I have a friend who was taking their 5-year-old to summer camp, and it's like, okay, what's your 5-year-old's pronoun? And it's like, now that's not a threat to your child necessarily, but it does tell you, well, what is this program really about, right? If you think 5-year-olds have any idea, you know, what it means to have pronouns and all that stuff. So I think there are a lot of people who want to push back on how far corporations and others are going on these things. And knowing that in the background, folks on the far left have been effective in pushing corporations this way. Because let's be honest, the corporations are about the bottom line. That doesn't mean there's nobody within the corporation that doesn't have a passion for these issues. I'm sure people are. But at the end of the day, they're about the bottom line. And I think they've been pushed in this direction, not because of some type of virtue, but because they think it's good for branding and good for the bottom line. And how else do you push back at that other than to say it's actually not good for your bottom line? Now, we can debate exactly how much of an impact this had, but it seems to me from the outside, and I've read different articles about it, that this has had a direct economic impact, financial impact on these organizations. I think it is a fair boycott. I don't think it's the same as Operation Breadbasket. It's different times, a different thing going on. It is a fair boycott. And I know several people who will not be going to Target anytime soon. And I think they're with not only within their rights to do that, but it makes sense that they're taking that action. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I think that folks are definitely within their right to do it. I think it's important that people actually do it. Because as you said, this is not an issue that has legitimately come through the public discourse. There are people who feel very strongly about it. And again, I don't think that it is okay for us to structure society in a way that corporate power becomes unchecked power. So if the corporations have embraced an idea or a concept, then the whole society just has to embrace it. No, people have to be able to, and I think we should be developing the muscle within our communities to push back on corporate power. I think at the same time, I want to bring in another piece, because one of the articles that we were looking at, Justin, brings up this idea of, I guess, what is not a boycott that has manifested yet, but it's a potential boycott of Chick-fil-A. And this is based on the idea they have, like, this DEI expert, and they're doing a diversity, equity, and inclusion work at Chick-fil-A. And some of that conversation is going viral, and people are suggesting a boycott. And this is actually where I get a little bit uncomfortable for those of us who want to try to steward this tactic well. Like you talked about earlier, like the humility that we have to bring as Christians to this conversation, where we have not always entered it with the level of compassion that we need to. And so as I'm looking at stuff on social media, I'm thinking, like, let's explore this a little bit more closely. And here's why. I don't want to quickly conflate Chick-fil-A having a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer with a trans person promoting Budweiser or transaction in Target. Because here, we're not talking about pride flags on chicken sandwich boxes. We're talking about the company trying to create a culture, which folks who listen to the podcast know my issues with the overall kind of DEI industry. But if we step back from the industry and just actually think about the terms diversity, equity, and inclusion, I don't think any reasonable person is actually opposed to diversity or equity or inclusion. And so I want to learn a lot more about, I mean, a reasonable person. I think I would go ahead and argue that a person who's against those is unreasonable. I want to learn more about that, because we're talking about a company who has been dragged into court, blocked from expanding their business, actually suffered some economic impact for this kind of unswerving commitment to that historic Christian sexual ethic. But then they're coming around and saying that, hey, we're not going to compromise on that. We believe in that. But still, we want people, even people we disagree with, to feel respected in our working environment. Yeah. And I actually think that's something compelling about that. I don't know enough about it to straight up defend it, but I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, because I feel like usually when you're taking it from both sides, you're probably doing something right. And so I wouldn't want to conflate this Chick-fil-A thing with the other boycotts that are taking
place. Yeah, certainly not. And let me say this before I get into it. You know, we try to be as transparent as possible. So we don't want to have any connection to organizations or anything like that we don't tell you about. So number one, got a lot of people I know that work for Chick-fil-A. I've worked with them before. I've actually done some speaking to Chick-fil-A on their diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is very different than you would see DEI FBI from other companies that weren't explicitly Christian. They've gone out of their way to make sure that people feel included and that they're acknowledging diversity, but in a different way. And they've, and I can tell you in the work that I've done with them on that, they've gone the extra mile to make sure that they get the benefit of it and not add all the other stuff. Because I'll be honest with you, here's my problem with this potential boycott. Number one, it's just bad strategy. Number one, because when you just start boycotting everything because you had a couple successes, you're eventually going to run out of social capital and people just stop listening to you. People can only do so many things at once. Okay, so terrible strategy for whoever came up with this at the moment. But just because you hear DEI doesn't mean you know the substance of what it is. And I know people get triggered when they hear certain words, and that's become one of those words without even looking to the substance and what they mean of it. Like I said, the talk that I gave about it was very different than what you would see at a lot of organizations. Okay. I think they've earned probably the benefit of the doubt. And if you disagree with them, then you still have every right to do the boycott, even if it's not a great idea. Thinking about it that way is really important because you want to know the substance of something and not always just react to a certain word. Okay. So I want to say that, but I also, Chris, want to go back to the first conversation, which we're going to fire our producer because I was going to bring up Chick-fil-A later and you stepped on my toes on that. That's not your fault, Chris. That's our producer's fault, who is actually me. I do want to go back to the Target example, because I think what's going on when you talk about these corporations, and we know that they're really about the bottom line. This is not just all about virtue. What people are trying to do is normalize the issue. Right? They're trying to normalize every element of the LGBTQ conversation. And while I truly believe and will sacrifice to make sure that people are treated fairly and compassionately, that nobody is bullied, that nobody is treated wrongly, there are some things that I don't think should be normalized. And there's some things a lot of Americans, Christians and otherwise, within that they don't think should be normalized. And so when you bring in these corporations with their outsized voice in our democracy, in ways how they are challenging the integrity of our democracy because they have so much power, people do need to push back. And this goes to what you were saying. People do need to push back to say, that's not something that I want normalized. And just because you think you can skip the public discourse and go straight to the academy or go straight to corporations doesn't mean I have to take it. In that, I think people are right in what they're doing, even if it's different than what you saw in the civil rights movement, because it's different issues. It's not necessarily about exclusion. It is about messaging, and messaging matters, especially when we're talking about our kids. And what I don't think the left understands is when you're talking about things that impact people's kids, you really have to be pluralistic. And I don't think they understand pluralism when it comes to people's kids. You don't get to say that your opinion matters more than somebody else's parents, even if you disagree with their values. You don't get to do that. And as long as the left thinks they get to do that, they're going to run into a lot of pressure. And I'll be on the front lines of people saying, no, 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 don't think you get to influence my kids because you know better than me. In a pluralist democracy, whether you think you have the right values or you agree with them or not, or have the right opinions, you don't get to just jump over them and indoctrinate their kids for something else. And I don't think the left gets that. I think they've painted this in a very, you know, it's very virtuous for what they're doing in terms of other people's kids. But I think they're going to continue to get beat back when they do that. But go ahead, Chris, take us out.
Yeah, I think so. I'll take one aside. And I think we should have a time on here where we talk about this, because it's still right now mostly trapped in the academy, but there is this space on the left where we have taken our sort of community ethic, which I am very supportive of, but and pushed it. We've pushed it too far, and it's formally being discussed already in the academy. This idea that children belong more to the society than to the family. And that's another one of those things that needs to be vigorously debated, because as much of a communitarian as I count myself to be, I wholly disagree with that assessment. Folks have to think about that. You also have to think about, and again, I think this is important for those who are justice oriented, you know, whether you're coming from the left or the right, if you have this agenda that you support, you really have to ask yourself if you want to enforce it through corporate power.
Right.
Right. Because if corporations get to do whatever they want to do, you might be on the same side of the corporation when it comes to Pride Month and LGBTQ issues, but are you on the same side of the corporations when it comes to paid leave and wages in general, corporate buybacks, tax law? Like there are a lot of things that corporations get to dictate. And every time you hold up a large corporation as this kind of standard bearer of morality, you make it that much more difficult to fight corporations on all the rest of those fronts. And so I think there's a lot for us to think about before we come down too hard on people who want to boycott corporate entities because they're doing something that these people disagree
with. No, that's real. And somebody might say, well, would you feel the same way if it came down to race? And I would say, absolutely. I don't need large corporations to push my messaging in that regard. Again, because I don't necessarily know that it's coming from the right place. And that's not a benefit to me. I'm not going to empower a corporation in that way so they can also be empowered to continue to do what do to the economy with some of them, not all of them, but some of them are doing. So I think you make a great point. And I just want people to understand when it comes to people's kids and influencing people's kids, you better know that a lot of people would rather die than accept the idea that you get to influence their kids more than they do. People just aren't going to accept that, nor should they. And like I said before, I'll be on the front lines of pushing back against that because you may think that you're so right that it's OK. Democracy comes with the assumption that you're never so right, which is why we have the process and which is why we have parental rights. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND Campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND Campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction. The AND Campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. We just had a conversation about some boycotts, whether certain boycotts are good, whether other boycotts may be immoral if they're pushing the wrong things. And now I want to talk a little bit, Chris, about another phenomenon that's dealing with our cities. And both of us are obviously living in two major cities. And so this has an impact on us. So according to The Hill, 2 million people fled America's largest cities from 2020 to 2022. A report published by the Bipartisan Economic Innovation Group found that more than 1.2 million people left the nation's largest urban counties between July 2020 and July 2021. Another 860,000 left between July 2021 and July 2022. The article says, only a fresh influx of immigrants, interesting, saved big cities from a dramatic population decline. The historic exodus, combined with chronic office vacancies and surging crime, passed profound and potentially existential challenges to America's great cities. Now, they say in this article that the nightmare scenario would be a gradual unraveling of the social fabric that made big cities attractive to live and work in the new millennium and a return to the urban decay of preceding decades. So as many of you know, mostly our communities were impacted by this because folks can come in and go out as they want to outside of some of our communities. In the 80s, you know, if you went to New York City, if you went to, you know, Chicago and other places in the 80s and 70s, the inner cities were in pretty bad shape. Some of these spots were able, or some locations within these cities were able to gentrify and change to where they became attractive for other people to come in. The worry is those who are mobile enough leave the cities once again and they go into that urban decay. I think that's what the Hill is getting at. Now, we know, Chris, that the pandemic and the remote work that came with the pandemic obviously played a major role in this exodus. And as the Hill article points out, you know, some people would also say that it was coupled with a rise in crime. OK, big city homicides rose by 2/5 between 2019 and 2022. It went from 6,400 murders or homicides to 9,100 homicides. New York City alone recorded 438 homicides in 2022, which was up from 313 in 2019. Joel Kotkin from Unheard, which is an online publication, notes that in 1950, the core cities accounted for 24% of the American population. Today, the share is under 15%. Roughly 80% of all job growth has been in suburbs. That's interesting here. For the past decade, the leading job-creating metro areas have gone away from cities like New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles and towards Austin, Salt Lake, Nashville, Phoenix, and Raleigh. Places like New York, San Francisco, and Chicago are built around big central business districts and the notion that people have to be in that geography to succeed. What happens when that changes? Big cities, even dense ones, need to be receptive to reality. This is what the Unheard article is saying. They need to be receptive to reality. Grandiose visions may be beloved by the urban-centric media, but the future cannot be secure by building to the clouds. And in confronting the gritty street-level realities, now chasing even the urban-minded out of the country's great cities. Chris, it seems to me that this exodus, which I want to point out, has slowed down since the pandemic, but still is very serious, especially in places like Chicago. This presents a pretty grim future in some ways for big cities if things don't change. What do you take from this exodus and what do you think is to come in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and Chicago might be in a little bit of a unique situation where we've had this exodus going since like 2010, kind of slow drip. And so it's welcome news that the overall population decline slowed. But again, as the article points out, that's not because the exodus slowed, right? That's fewer deaths, more foreign immigrants, more babies born. Not really a slowing in the exodus. So people are still on the whole, not necessarily trying to be here. It's a really, really serious problem for big cities. I worked in a mayoral campaign in 2018 and 2019 here in Chicago with some of the smartest policy people I've ever been around. And we crunched numbers every which way. And the long and short of it is simply that the Chicago that I grew up in the 90s and the 2000s, even the Chicago of 10 years ago, it really, the city doesn't function at a very high level when the taxpaying population drops below 3 million. We also saw in those calculations that things begin to break down in some really critical ways when that population dips under 2.75 million. And we were just about that number. We didn't win that campaign. Chicago population was just about that number, 2.75 million, going into 2020. Now we're about 100,000 people below that. And you're beginning to see some of those critical failures. You can't keep up the same level of public service, public transit, festivals, every like tiny thing from like the church has been up in arms because they cut the gospel fest down to one day, right? But you can't keep doing all that stuff when you're not getting the revenue. And so it's a really, really important thing. And I do think that, you know, life is getting hard. You know, I've traveled in the last 6 months. I've been in Atlanta. I've been in Dallas. I've been in Phoenix. And every trip, somebody says something about we should move here, right? Because it's getting really expensive. It's getting really hard to live in Chicago. I like what the Hill article pointed out. There was similar thinking. An article I read in Wall Street Journal, which is folks don't seem in a lot of cities to be taking this particular issue very seriously yet. I am dubious at best of anybody who is promising to improve the quality of life for the average resident of a big city without figuring out how to get us off this population death spiral, which is really hard to do.
But it does seem like some people in Chicago think they have an answer, which is the local income tax.
Local income tax. A transit tax, right? Tax some people who come in from the suburbs working. That stuff is not going to work, right? Like, Chicago is a city, not even a state. Even when states raise their taxes too much.
But the state, Illinois, has already done that, right? Like, how do you add another tax and think that's going to be?
And we've already seen corporations and people leave, right? Because it's not just corporations that leave, which is what a lot of people talk about. Oh, well, the corporations. No, individuals. When you look and you see that you're paying so much sales tax, you buy something that costs $1 and end up paying $1.62. You're paying that sales tax. You got to pay $300 for a city sticker and $250 to, you know, park in front of your house. And like, that makes people leave. And a lot of folks, at least in my city, I can't speak for every city, but in my city, I don't think enough people are dealing with this question.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting because you got to know that at some time, and we're not against tax, you know what I mean? Like, we're probably center left when it comes to taxation, right? At some point, you got to come to the conclusion that you've exhausted the revenue that you're going to get from extra taxes and penalties and whatever else you find ways to get money out of people for the government for. At some point, you've gone too far, especially when you're in a state that already has very high taxes. So you got to be creative. And I think what you want to do is bring more taxpayers into the city limits and not necessarily tax them more. Because at some point, something has to give. Here in Atlanta, we had a big battle. Buckhead, which is part of the city, was, because of crime and other things, was saying that they wanted to leave the city. Well, what people know is that's a huge tax base. So it's like, we can't, you know, there has to be a conversation about this not happening, because if city government is really about services, it's hard to provide services and get help to the people who need it when you don't have a tax base. And what people have to understand is all people have to do, especially in this day and age, is go right outside of the city limits. And then you really lost, because whatever you add on to that after they've left the city limits is not going to be enough to get the income that you were getting from the property taxes, or what have you. So yeah, it's a tough situation for cities. It's one we have to think a little bit harder. And as much as I've told and truly believe that Republicans have to break away from Reaganomics, I'm happy to see Compass and other folks are actually doing that. Democrats have to do the same thing. You're right. It can't be even tax and spend on a local level and every level that you see. And you think that's going to solve a problem that it hasn't solved before. Everybody has to start thinking out the box in this. Look at the data, have conversations, bring it into the discourse where it's not about, you know, maintaining my economic orthodoxy, but it really is about getting to the heart of the matter. But go ahead, Chris.
We started off the show talking about a deal being reached on the debt ceiling, right? Cities don't have the ability to vote and raise your debt ceiling, right? Like, it's a fundamentally different thing. So if you have this kind of fiscal orthodoxy and ideology that's mostly forced in the context of federal government, it doesn't apply. Like, it doesn't work that way.
So is that legislation still up for the local income tax or any of that stuff?
It is. I mean, we haven't gotten a budget in this new administration. We have to have a budget, and we'll see what's the idea of funding the kind of budget that has been envisioned in terms of the promises that.
And this isn't even dealing with the pension and things like that, which is, I mean,
no, I don't know if every city has the pension mess that we have, but we have an almost, I don't know. And I don't claim to be the smartest person on policy, but I think about policy a lot. And I know really, really smart people on policy. And Chicago's pension situation is a real pickle.
And it's one of the things, I mean, this is another issue we're not going to get into, but it's one, something to think about when you and I are really thinking about, okay, how do we get more power to workers? And maybe that's just on the private side so much and the importance of unions and all that. But then seeing where, okay, we have to be thoughtful about that side of it too, right? And make sure that people are sensible in what they're asking for. Because you get in a situation where you ask for more than is actually there. And I think we've reached that point in some places. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. Back on the Church Politics Podcast. And as you know, we're going into 2024. I mean, this election cycle is basically up and rearing, especially when you're talking about the Republican presidential primary. We know that Trump is in the race. We had DeSantis jump in the race. We also had some other folks who I want to see if we can see kind of a path for them, right? So one person who made their official announcement was Tim Scott. It was an announcement that, you know, people that are in that space thought was pretty strong. He had some decent messaging. Somebody who else is rumored to be jumping into the race is Chris Christie. It said that Chris Christie will jump in next week. Now, Chris Christie is somebody who a lot of people say just missed his opportunity, that he should have ran when he had the opportunity to run against Barack Obama and maybe would have won. And he missed that opportunity. So let's start with Scott. Tim Scott, to me, seems like a decent guy. He doesn't seem he's not the Ted Cruz that we talked about last time. My personal issue with him is I think just like most people in the Senate and in the Republican Party, just went along with Trump too much, still is hesitant to criticize Trump. I don't know how you become president if you don't criticize one or the other, if you supported as much as you could and then you don't really criticize somebody else in that space. I struggle to see. And for that reason, among others, I struggle to see a path for him to become the president. Like, why would somebody vote for you over Trump on the issues that you just don't seem to want to really distinguish yourself on, right? The other thing is, and this only goes so far, and you may not think it's a big deal, I just don't see him as having I don't think voters see him as really a strong presidential, you know, as somebody who would be strong in that space. I don't think he doesn't come off to be just a super strong campaigner and just how he connect to people in a way that they would say that he should be an executive. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you say. I don't see much there for Scott. Maybe the best chance for him is maybe becoming the vice president, you know, the being in line for kind of that role. But he didn't have to run for president to be in line for that role. I'm not sure that set him apart. If you look at his numbers, he's like at 2%. He's below people that folks barely know. But just want to hear your thoughts on Senator Tim Scott in this race.
I kind of think he is running for vice president. And I do think that running gives him a little bit of a leg up when it comes to being a VP choice, just because he's going to get out there on the campaign. He's going to prove whatever campaign abilities he does have. He's going to be able to showcase them and might be able to cut a deal. As much as I agree with you that I
you got to get some support.
I don't know if he's got to get a ton of support. I think he's got to campaign well, connect in some important places. And when you think about some of those swing states where, because here's what I think about with Tim Scott, as much as he went along with Donald Trump, he's the one person in the Senate, probably the one person in the whole government who can say, I actually went into a negotiation with Donald Trump and came away with something meaningful that actually impacted the lives of people. And most of it is in cities, which is the empowerment zone that was inside of the what I think was a terrible tax bill, the Trump tax cut.
What constituency does he bring, though?
So I don't know that he brings a constituency, but I do think as a vice presidential nominee, if he learns to talk about empowerment zone, actually, I don't know if he knows a lot about how empowerment zones have been impactful in Chicago, in Minnesota, in Philadelphia, inside of these inner cities. He can go to those swing states, and all you got to do, and I've been around this in Illinois, it's a little bit different because Illinois is not necessarily a swing state, but we are at when it comes to statewide races. And whenever a Republican is running on the statewide level, the whole game is, can you drive down the margins in Cook County? And I think if Tim Scott on the ticket can drive down the margins in Cook County, drive down margins in Philadelphia suburbs. And I think that kind of demeanor that might make him a little less presidential seeming might also warm a Republican ticket with some of those kind of suburban voters. Because his vibe is like he's got that nice guy vibe, which might help. I mean, so My take on Tim Scott is that he's running for vice president. I think that he's putting himself in a...
And there's always the question, does a vice president ever bring anybody? You know what I mean? Do they ever... And maybe they warm the ticket. Who knows? There always is that question. And I'll be honest with you, even as we go into talking about Chris Christie, I don't know that I see a path for anybody but Trump, maybe DeSantis, maybe not, right? Christie, and let me be straight up with Christie. I actually liked Christie back in the day. I liked his style, like how he went about it. He was somewhat, you know, center left. As time passed and some of my views have changed, I'm much more skeptical of people who have the kind of Wall Street ties that he has. And maybe it's just a 2008 thing that I finally said, no, I can't trust nobody who has those kind of ties, who I don't think can come in and say, I'm not going to give you everything you want. And we've had a lot of folks in a row that have basically said, hey, you know, let me write you a blank check. Even if you mess up everything, I'm still going to hold you down. So for me, even as somebody who somewhat liked Christie back in the day, I can't see myself. Well, let me not go there. I don't see myself as high on him as I was before.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not now. I don't think I've ever been like a huge Chris Christie fan. And I agree with you. I think that everybody who's getting this Republican primary is getting in because it's Donald Trump's race to lose. But Donald Trump has been in the arena with President Joe Biden. So he like seems young in that context, but he's not young. Right. Like he's also really old. You know, he's got like 15 different attorneys general trying to like take him down. And so I don't know if anybody is really thoroughly convinced that they can straight up beat him. If something happens, you got to be in the race to win. So
that would be an interesting race to see those guys without Trump. You know, what would become of that? That'd be an interesting race because like you said, anything can happen. It almost seems like anything can happen means more without Trump, because it's like if he's still there, it seems like there's going to be people who vote for him. But we've been around this game to know you don't know. I mean, there's so much time left. You don't know what's going to happen, how people react. It does seem like Trump has a base that he is bulletproof when it comes to anything that may come to him. But we'll have to see.
I think, you know, those of us who love politics, we prognosticate because it's fun. Only people who really know are voters. And my experience, they tend to make up their minds really late in the process.
Yeah. Somebody, I'll tell you, though, and we talked about this a little bit on the Democratic side, RFK Jr. comes off a lot differently than other candidates do. And his voice is a little different. At first, I was like, man, it's hard to listen to. But he comes off as very honest that, hey, you may disagree with me, but I'm going to be honest in how I address things. I think that's going to have an appeal for people who are really just sick of the lies. Somebody else to keep an eye on. But I did, as we go on, as we go into 2024, we're just going to kind of give some assessments of what we think about the candidates. Like I said, I think Tim Scott seems like a nice enough guy. I don't know if he's a draw for people, just how he comes off. I could be wrong. Chris Christie, I think, I don't know what, I don't, you know, if Trump wins, he's definitely not going to be a vice presidential candidate. Could just be a vanity play. Who knows? But he will definitely make the debates interesting, ask Marco Rubio. So yeah. that'll be something else to keep an eye on.
Yeah. There are things about Tim Scott that I like. And I think that he knows something about how Black folks and super, super progressive, not Black folks, the color of your skin just factors in significantly into how a lot of people vote. And then he has that nice guy vibe. I think that's what he's doing, is trying to present himself as somebody who can add something to your presidential ticket, whoever wins the top spot, particularly if that somebody is Donald Trump.
We shall see. Maybe I'm a little too pessimistic on that, but we shall see. Well, thank you for joining us as always. I hope you got something out of this conversation. You know how we do in camp. There's a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. We'll holler at you. Dear Lord. Dear Lord. Pay for my sins, Lord. I'm black as a